Thank you very much for the opportunity to give this talk, and thanks for everyone for coming. And if you want to interrupt at any time, yeah, just go ahead. So any theory of quantum gravity has to account for bulk diffeomorphism invariance at the semi-classical level. And there's basically two ways in which we could do this, very broadly speaking. So either that diffeomorphism invariance is fundamentally present, or it's only emergent in the semi-classical regime. And I don't know which of these is ultimately true, but some models like ADS-CFT give evidence that we could take the latter seriously. So in holography, the bulk itself is an emergent feature of the theory. So it stands to reason that diffeomorphisms of that bulk should be emergent as well. But diffeomorphism invariance is a kind of gauge symmetry. So what does it really mean for gauge symmetry to be emergent? Well, gauge symmetries are redundancies in whatever description we use of reality. And we only use them because they allow us to more easily understand the physics that underlies the models that we use. Well, in different physical regimes, we might use different descriptions of reality, and those descriptions might be redundant in different ways, which means that they involve different kinds of gauge symmetry. And if there's a redundancy in the description in one regime, but that redundancy isn't there in the description of a more fundamental regime, then it's reasonable to think of that redundancy as emergent, or that would be emergent gauge symmetry. And in this talk, the more fundamental regime will be a quantum theory, and the less fundamental regime will be a semi-classical limit. Actually, it will be a classical limit, just as a first step. And from what I've said, you might be under the impression that gauge symmetries aren't physically relevant, because they're just features of what we're using to describe physics. But this isn't completely true. For example, in field theory and gravity, the usual role of gauge symmetry is to allow us to describe non-local degrees of freedom using mathematically local structures. So if you prefer, you can think of this talk as being about emergent non-local degrees of freedom. And if you want to learn more about these perspectives, I can recommend these two essays. But really, that's just setting the scene. So we're talking about emergent physics, and we're talking about emergent physics in gravity. It's very, we immediately think about quantum information, because in holography, the emergence of the bulk appears to be to do with quantum information. And our understanding of this is multifaceted and well-developed, but we're still far from knowing the undoubtedly rather complicated full story. But I'm going to focus just on the link between gauge symmetry and entanglement. And although the motivation comes from gravity, I won't restrict to gravity. And there's good reason to expect these concepts to be linked more generally. So I've already explained how gauge invariance is a reflection of non-locality. And the same is true of entanglement, because essentially entanglement is the non-local distribution of quantum information between subsystems. So the possibility I want to explore is, if that information is sufficiently well behaved in a classical limit, then perhaps it describes some emergent non-local degrees of freedom, and perhaps you can account for that with the language of gauge symmetry. And this is, yeah, this would give away for the title of the talk to happen. So yeah, I'm gonna confirm this happens. I'll identify the mechanism. And what I'll describe is very precise and elementary, but it's also quite a general thing. It just uses, it's basically just, you have quantum theory and you have a very general structure, and then this happens. And it's sufficiently general that I think it maybe it should apply in some way to the gravitational case, and also wouldn't be surprised if it applies to other known examples of emergent gauge symmetry in condensed matter, for example. And there are a couple of key takeaways. So the first one, you don't need to use something like a traditional constraint quantization if you want to quantize a theory with gauge symmetry. You can use entanglement instead, so long as you don't insist on that gauge symmetry being present at the quantum level. And another takeaway is that the structure of multipartite entanglement, which is a notoriously complicated, simplifies significantly in the classical limit because you can just describe it with gauge symmetry. Okay, so are there any questions about the motivation and setup? Okay. Okay, well, as I've said, the mechanism is general, but for illustrative purposes, it's convenient to first look at a simple toy example involving three entangled spins. And depending on how much experience you have with these kinds of things, this might be either incredibly obvious what I say or kind of surprising. But okay, so the standard picture of a classical limit of a spin. So we take a spin J, let this be the usual eigenbasis, and we construct coherent states. This is undergraduate quantum mechanics. And we have one of these coherent states for each unit three vector. And these states allow us to consider the classical limit of the spin, which is a large angular momentum limit, where the J becomes large. And the reason this is a classical limit is because the overlap of these states when you consider two different vectors is zero if those vectors are different in this limit, and it's one if they're the same. So we have sort of classical transition probabilities. So we have a two-sphere of possible classical states, and any classical observable on that two-sphere, so a function on the two-sphere, can be written in this way in the quantum theory. And in the large J limit, the action of that operator will be the same as multiplying by the classical observable. So now that's one spin. So suppose we take three spins. So first I'll look at the unentangled case. And we can do a very obvious thing. We just take the tensor product of three of these coherent states. And really this is unentangled. And these states satisfy the generalization of the previous thing. So they're approximately orthogonal in the large J limit. And so we get just three two-spheres as the classical space of states. And this is a perfectly valid classical limit, but there might be reasons in a given physical setup where we shouldn't use it. For example, these are all separable states, but maybe the spins are coupled together in such a way that entanglement is generated in significant ways. And then that dynamics wouldn't have a good description in the classical limit, a good deterministic description. So we should think about other kinds of classical limit. And so instead of working in terms of these separable states, I'm going to construct a different basis of states. So the first step is take the unique state of zero angular momentum. And this is highly entangled. You can write it in this way. And then I'm going to act with the SU2 representations on the first two spins. And that will give me a set of states labeled by points in three spheres. And so I have two SU2 actions that I've done. So I have two three spheres worth of such states. And what you can show is that these states also satisfy the classical transition probability property. So these states give a classical limit with a classical state space, which is a copy, which is a product of two three spheres. And you can also decompose the, you can also write the classical observables on this in terms of quantum operators and so on. Yeah, that's that. The sum measure, which is basically just the standard measures on the three spheres. So this is a different classical limit, basically. So let me just describe these two classical limits. Yes.
What is psi? A psi 1, psi 2?
So psi 1 and psi 2 are just some real number between 0 and pi. And
where do they enter the definition of the state?
So I'm acting with the SU2 generator on. So, yeah.
And M is. You need these extra numbers. You need to integrate them?
So each of these states is parameterized by psi and m. But if you want to write down.
So in the end, you have the same number of classical variables?
You mean, so the same dimension of the, yeah, which is an interesting. But yeah, I have a table that sort of summarizes these two things. So yeah, in the first case, we had just these three S2s, and then the second case, we have these two S3s. The classical regime is the same. The first case, these states are separable. The second case, they're highly entangled. The Hilbert space is the same, but the classical state spaces are different. This is kind of the point. In the first case, the local structure, the decomposition into three spins, that's clearly preserved. We have one classical S2 for each spin. But in the second case, it's not so obvious what has happened to the local structure. In the quantum theory, we have a decomposition into three systems, but in the classical theory, we have these two S3s. So what's happened?
Give you an example of the topology of the classical phase space changes.
Yeah, there's not even a continuous map between these.
In the first case, you get a phase space, right? It's equipped with in the second case, you don't get a phase space.
I think you do, because each S3 is not even dimensional, but the product of the two.
Okay, so there's no degeneracy.
I think technically there's a theorem that.
Okay.
You don't get the usual symplectic structure. It might be something like a quasi-symplectic structure.
Okay.
Yeah, there might be something. Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm asking. Like, if you have extra restriction demand, like mathematical, that you think there has to be a phase space, does that exclude classical limit or?
So there's in general going to be a map from a classical state space to the Hilbert space, and I think you want this map to be continuous and differentiable in some way.
Yeah, so that, I'm asking about symplectic. I mean, you said you read the presence of a symplectic structure. That's what I'm.
Mm-hmm. The symplectic structure on the classical space will be the pullback of the Berry curvature of the quantum states. So in order to construct that pullback, you need to have the right continuity and differentiability of the map. And
so is it related to entanglement, like whether these things exist or not? Or so you, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think this is a good question. So I'm not, thinking about it at this point, but it's sort of what I want to think about next is what the implications are for the symplectic structure and so on. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I haven't calculated it, but in this case, I think it wouldn't be a hard calculation to just try and see what the Berry curvature is in terms of these coordinates, and then compare that with the quasi-symplectic something around there, yeah. Okay, so we have a local structure in the quantum theory into three subsystems, but in the classical theory, we're not sure what's happened. But the way we can get at that local structure is by considering the reduced states in the quantum theory. So these are just, we we take a partial trace over the complement of whatever subsystem we're considering. So rho I will be the reduced state of a single spin, and rho ij will be a pair of spins. And it's not so hard to show that the reduced state of a single spin is always just proportional to the identity. It's just always the maximally mixed state. So really, there's only one possible classical state for each individual spin. And similarly, you can look at the reduced density matrices of pairs of spins. And what you find is that these are always approximately equal to a projection operator divided by the rank of the projection operator. And that these projection operators are labeled by a point in S3. And for different points in S3, they're approximately orthogonal. And I'll justify this more thoroughly later on, but really what this means is we only have an S3 of possible density matrices for each pair of spins. So there are S3 possible states in the classical limit for each pair of spins. And yeah, this property is quite important, and I'll show that it holds more generally later on. Okay. So to recover the local structure in the entangled case, we can use a gauge symmetry. So for each spin, we define a space of kinematical states, which will just be a copy of SU2. And then the gauge group we use is another SU2 that just acts on all of the spins simultaneously from the right, say. And so the space of physical states for the whole system, you get an S3 times S3. And for each individual spin, you get a singleton, because you're just dividing SU2 by itself. And for each pair of spins, you get an S3. So you get the required structure. And this S3 for the pair of spin is parameterizing non-local degrees of freedom, because it's measuring the kinematical state of one spin relative to the kinematical state of the other spin. So going back to this table, the local structure is actually preserved still in the second case. It's just we have to use a gauge symmetry to access it. So it's a very simple toy example of what's happening. And I'm saying it's emergent because if you look at the Hilbert space in the second case, there are no constraints between these three systems. So there's no gauge symmetry in the quantum theory, even though there's a emergent gauge symmetry in the classical theory. Okay, are there any more questions about this simple illustrative example?
Maybe you're going to address that later, but here you have highly symmetric objects where everything is defined in terms of the group in the beginning. So you find that the structure and the entanglement is associated with a group of symmetry. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that might be in general, random entanglement might not be of that nature, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the subspace of entanglement that is really associated with a local group, that's something very specific.
Right, yes. So
again, it's the gauge symmetry, you have a very specific nature of entanglement. There's a certain nature of entanglement that gives you the symmetry, but I would expect that most entanglements are not of that nature, right?
Yes. So yeah, I'm going to describe next about how there's a sort of a simple criterion that tells you that you think about when a subsystem is well behaved in a classical limit, and then you impose that condition, and you can find basically very, very similar structure. So it's not, you won't get the very well behaved exact SU2 intertwiner entanglement symmetry here, but you'll get something that's very approximately in the sense of it holds in the classical limit within some notion of convergence. Any other questions? I hope when I describe this it'll make it. Okay.
Actually,
yes.
Sorry, because you said the sentence that the local structure is preserved in the second case, but you have to use the emergent gauge symmetry to. Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate on that? I kind of didn't understand.
Yeah, so So the space of kinematical states is this, so for each spin we have a space of kinematical states, and this n1 kin times n2 kin times n3 kin, that's the space of kinematical states for the full system. So it's like in Yang-Mills, say we have the gauge potential at different points, and we can locally specify that gauge potential, but then we have to impose constraints and divide by the gauge group, and it's basically the same thing that's happening here. We can specify a kinematical state in a completely local manner, but to get to the actual physical states, we have to reduce by the gauge symmetry. So the local structure is there at the kinematical level, I guess. Yeah, I don't know if that. I don't know.
This is just the second case.
Yeah. Well, in the first case, it's obvious that the local structure is there because we just have an S2 labeling each spin. But like this classical state space, like in the Yang-Mills case, the physical state space, it just gives you like the values of Wilson loops and things. In that sense, it doesn't really know about the local structure of the space-time or whatever. But clearly that local structure is still there, and the way that you get at it is by introducing the gauge group to write things in terms of local variables. And this is the same kind of.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Right. So this property about the classical limit of subsystems. Let me now talk about that. So a physical system has local structure if it's composite. For me, that's all I'm gonna use. So basically, that means it's divisible into subsystems. So in the example that we had the spins, in a QFT, the subsystems might be subregions. And each subsystem has a set of observables local to it. And by thinking about those sets of observables, we can understand when there are non-local degrees of freedom. Because if we look at the set of observables for a union of subsystems, and that set contains observables that can't be decomposed into the observables of the two subsystems, then that means we must be measuring some non-local degrees of freedom. To understand emergent gauge symmetry, we need to know what happens to subsystems when we take a classical limit. And this is non-trivial, so not all quantum subsystems will be well behaved in such a limit. So for example, if we took a very small subregion in a QFT, fields will fluctuate enough that it'll be difficult to assign a definite value to the classical fields, a definite classical value to the fields in a classical limit. And understanding when we can take a classical limit of the subsystems, this is sort of necessary for being able to use the same local structure at both the classical and the quantum levels. So what is a quantum subsystem? In general terms, it's just a von Neumann algebra, which is the algebra of observables. And it's some subset of the full space of operators acting on the Hilbert space of the full system. And for simplicity, I'm going to make some assumptions in this talk. The first is that the dimension of the Hilbert space is finite, although it might become arbitrarily large in the classical limit. And I'm also going to assume that there's no pre-existing gauge symmetry at the quantum level, because I'm only really interested at this point in emergent gauge symmetries. And in terms of the classification of von Neumann algebras, this means that it's a type 1 factor, which basically means we can write it in this way. So all of the operators in the algebra for the subsystem can just be written as the bounded operators on a tensor factor of the Hilbert space. And more generally, we might have a bunch of different subsystems that we decompose the Hilbert space to the tensor product, and each subsystem's algebra is just the bounded operators on each tensor factor. So that's a quantum subsystem. So what's a classical limit? In sort of very abstract general terms, you can think of a classical limit as being you have some space of classical states, which I've called N. The classical observables are functions on N. Maybe they're continuous, or you impose some other conditions on them. And then we want to embed those classical observables in the quantum theory. So we have some map from the algebra of functions to the algebra of operators. And this map should be approximately isomorphic. And by approximately isomorphic, I mean that all of the isomorphism conditions hold, but only sort of in a convergent sense in the classical limit. And that classical limit, I'll call the parameter chi going to zero. That could be h bar or g Newton or 1 over n squared or this angular momentum of a spin or whatever. And then at leading order in chi, we can implement this map from classical observables to quantum operators by using projection operators. So here, each chi hat of x is something that we can measure to determine whether the classical degrees of freedom are in the state x. And so the classical degrees of freedom can't be in more than one state, so these operators have to approximately be orthogonal to each other. And then we can represent any classical observable as a quantum operator by integrating the function over the classical states.
So you don't include like commutator is mapped to Poisson brackets for functions.
The commutator, so there'll be like order chi corrections to these equations, and that would be where you would find the Poisson bracket.
Oh, you mean as a product?
Yeah, I mean technically in the commutator. Obviously, this kind of structure might be difficult to find in general, but this is the properties of a classical limit that I want to use.
Sorry, N is a it's not a manifold space. And you have a measure on N.
Yeah. So. So in general, it's just some measure. If N is a phase space, then
classical state, you mean a phase space.
Yeah, I mean I'm avoiding saying phase space at this point because I'm
you don't know if it's invertible or something. Or you don't have a problem.
Yeah, I'm not worrying about the Poisson structure at the moment or the symplectic structure.
Yeah, but you need a preferred measure then.
Yeah. So the measure could be, if it's a symplectic space, it could be like the Liouville form, or if it's a coadjoint orbit, it could be the KKS form.
The measure, is it encoded into the hat in some way? Like, what's the relationship between the quantum and the measure?
Mm-hmm.
Different measure would be different operators. Or what's the...
Yeah, there is some. There's going to be some constraint between these two things. Like, if you recall the spin case, this N was just a two-sphere, the measure was just the standard measure on the two-sphere, and these projection operators were just the projections onto the coherent states. So, I mean, yeah, in general.
In general, it could be a discrete measure, it doesn't become
continuous. Yeah, yeah, it could be a discrete measure, yeah. Okay, so these projection operators are, like I said, they're things we measure to determine the classical state.
Maybe if you go back,
yes.
I think it's a question I asked. Like, if you take L2R and I take a state delta x, mm-hmm. does that satisfy your definition of classical limit or? I mean, the projection operators would be basically
mm-hmm.
delta xy or something.
Yeah, I think by looking at the order chi corrections, mm-hmm. that's when we would start eliminating those kinds of states, because we would want to get the classical Poisson algebra structure, and those kinds of states wouldn't, like the map from classical position to position eigenstate isn't a yeah, it isn't differentiable in the right way that you would get a symplectic form on the classical state space. There are more things that go into saying what a classical limit is than what I've just written here, but this is the structure that I want to use in what I'm describing.
Okay. No, we are kind of always asking about the symplectic structure. That's why I'm kind of asking about the example is just one dimensional.
Yeah, I want to understand what happens to the symplectic structure for sure. So these projection operators measure the state of the classical degrees of freedom as x. But if the rank of the projection operator is greater than one, then that means that there's more than one quantum state compatible with a given classical state. So that means that if I tell you the state of the classical degrees of freedom, there's still some quantum degrees of freedom left over, which I would have to tell you the state of them as well. But usually we don't want that to be the case, so I'll call this a complete classical limit. And that's just the case where these projection operators are rank one.
Maybe a question, I mean, just to remember, what about spin? You know,
what do you,
spin of particle, and maybe we want to have that.
For sure.
There are elements in classical physics.
For sure, I agree, yeah. I'm just gonna focus on this case, I guess. Yeah, maybe it was too strong to say usually, but I mean, if that's a classical spin, then we can treat it classically. Maybe it will be part of the space N. But actually what I'll find is that, yeah, when you think about subsystems, these projection operators aren't necessarily rank one, in even if this full system is, but yeah, I'll get to that. Okay, so yeah, this is what we had in the toy model with the spins. Okay, so now that I've very fuzzily told you what a quantum subsystem is and what a classical limit is, I can say how you take the classical limit of a subsystem, and basically we have two sets of operators defining both of these things, and it's very natural to just take the intersection of these operators, because AS is the operators on the quantum subsystem, C is the classical operators, so your intersection will be the classical operators of the subsystem. And once I have this set of operators, in the classical limit, it's a commutative C star algebra, up to questions of convergence, which I won't go into. But that means that you can apply a version of the Gelfand-Neimark theorem, which tells us that this set of operators will be approximately isomorphic to an algebra of functions on some space. And since these are operators, classical operators of the subsystem, it makes sense to think of the space NS as the space of states of the subsystem. And explicitly, we can construct this space of states in this way, so it can be thought of as a set of maps acting on these operators, which for each classical state of the full system, we just map the operator to the expectation value, that operator. And then if we want to turn an operator in CS into a function on NS, we just turn it around in this way. And one of the points is that these states only depend on the reduced density matrix of the subsystem, which makes sense, I guess. Now this construction of the space of classical states in a subsystem works for any subsystem. But in general, it's not going to fully account for the physics in S, in the subsystem. And the reason is that this is a space of states for the classical degrees of freedom in the subsystem, but it's not necessarily true that if we know what those classical degrees of freedom are, then we know the full state of the subsystem. So, yeah, a complete classical limit doesn't necessarily imply that the quantum subsystems are completely classical. And so for an extreme example of what might happen, this set is defined in this way. Each operator in the classical subsystem operators set, we have to be able to write it as a hat s times identity, but we also have to be able to write it as an integral over these classical states. And this is quite a strong condition. And yeah, in an extreme case, it might be the only operators proportional to the identity will satisfy this condition. And then that would mean that there's only one element in NS, so there's no classical degrees of freedom in the subsystem. So we need to use quantum degrees of freedom entirely. But I'm interested in the opposite case, so where the classical degrees of freedom are sufficient. So there's a way we can precisely define what this means. So suppose we know that the full system is in some definite classical state, though we don't know which one. I'll say that the subsystem is classically resolvable if knowledge of its classical freedom, degrees of freedom, determine the quantum state to a high degree of accuracy in the classical limit. So more precisely, if I have two classical states for the full system such that the reduced density matrices in the subsystem are the same, I already know that the classical subsystem states are the same. This is sort of by definition of those classical subsystem states. As I said, the reduced states determine the classical state. But what we can say is, if I can do the reverse, so if the two classical states are the same, I know that the reduced states are the same, then that means I can completely determine the quantum state given the knowledge of the classical degrees of freedom. Okay, so once I have this condition, there's something I can immediately deduce about the states of these subsystems. So suppose I have a classically resolvable subsystem. So an operator in that CS can be written in this way. And if I take the trace over the complement on both sides and divide by the dimension of the Hilbert space of the complement, then I can write this. So this is just a way of writing the A hat S as an integral over states. But now, if I'm in a classically resolvable subsystem, I can measure the reduced state. That's basically what it means, because I can measure the classical degrees of freedom, and the classical degrees of freedom tell me the reduced state. So I can just set this function, which is the classical observable, to be 1 if the reduced state is equal to some fixed reduced state and 0 otherwise. And if I put that into the formula, then I see that a hat s is approximately proportional to rho s of x. But on the other hand, if I look at star, on the right-hand side, I have an integral over projection operators integrated against some indicator function. And these projection operators are all approximately orthogonal to each other. So this implies that a hat of s is itself approximately proportional to projection operators. So if I use these two results, what I find is that in a classically resolvable subsystem, the reduced density matrix is always approximately proportional to a projection operator. And if you remember, this is what happened in the toy model. Okay. And this is a classical operator. It measures whether the subsystem state is XS. And because the classical degrees of freedom can't be more than one state, we have this mutual orthogonality condition. And so, yeah, this is a strong constraint on the entanglement between the subsystems. Now, given this formula, we can write the classical subsystem operators in this way. And actually, because the integrand only depends on xs, we can write it as an integral over just ns, where I just push forward the measure. And if you compare this to how I described a classical limit before, this is basically the same structure. So the subsystem can be described with a self-contained classical limit. But in general, the rank of these projection operators doesn't have to be one. So this isn't a complete classical limit, even though the full system underwent a complete classical limit, which is kind of confusing because it's sort of defined classically resolvable so that I would be eliminating quantum degrees of freedom. But so what's happened? So we're assuming that the subsystem is part of a larger system and that the larger system is in some fixed classical state. And this is extra information, and that will constrain the apparent quantum degrees of freedom. And so this is a non-local property. There's a non-local dependence between the subsystem and the full system. And that's sort of the first hint that there's some gauge symmetry happening. So let me now describe how that works. So I'm going to take a completely classical limit of a quantum system. I assume that the quantum system has a classically resolvable local structure, so I can divide it into classically resolvable subsystems. And also any union of subsystems is classically resolvable. And so that means there's a classical space of states for each subsystem, and the reduced states are approximately proportional to projection operators. And the classical subsystem operators can be written in this way, and the projection operators are mutually orthogonal. So just repeating what I had. So this density matrix tells us how the subsystems are entangled. And in this case, because it's proportional approximately to a projection operator, that means that some part of the subsystem is maximally entangled with some part of its complement. So roughly speaking, they share log 2 nixi maximally entangled qubits.
Joshua?
Yes.
Just a minute, so you have like
10 to 15
minutes.
OK, I will speed. So yeah, so we usually think of entanglement as quantum mechanical, but let me now show that it, in the classical regime, you can think of it as gauge symmetry. So for a sanity check, we can look at separable subsystems, and there shouldn't be any gauge symmetry. And we can do this. So if we write down the classical operators, we just get the complete classical limit for each subsystem, unlike the entangled case. And the set of subsystem states is going to determine the full system state just by this equation. So there's a bijection between n and the product of the ni's. Which is the structure of the classical state space that we expect in the absence of gauge symmetry. So that's okay. But now returning to the entangled case, so we have these classical subsystem operators. And let me define C local to be the tensor product of all the classical subsystem operators. So these are operators which only depend on the local degrees of freedom. And the most general operator in this set can be written in this way. So I just integrate over all of the subsystem state spaces, and I have some classical function of the local degrees of freedom. And so if I want to talk about non-local degrees of freedom, I take all of the classical operators, I throw away the local operators, and then I'm just left over with non-local ones. So if this set is non-empty, then there has to be non-local degrees of freedom. And it's not hard to show that it is non-empty. So we just take a classical state, which is entangled. We come up with, we set this function A local to be 1 on that classical state. So that A hat local acting on the state is, this should say, ket x on the right-hand side, not one. And then if we compute the rank of this operator, we find that then it has to be greater than one. But on the other hand, this projection onto X is a classical operator, and it is rank one, and it it acts in the right way on X. So it has to be an element of C non-local. And this projection operator measures if the classical state is X. So what this means is, to know if the classical state is X, we have to know the state of some non-local degrees of freedom. And something that's interesting is that the presence of these non-local degrees of freedom depends on the exact way in which the state is entangled. And yeah, I'll go quickly, but state could be entangled in different ways in different states, so there'll be different non-local degrees of freedom. And you can show that this is measured by the mutual information. This counts how many non-local degrees of freedom there are in a given state. And I think maybe you can interpret this as a variable bulk topology. So the subsystems are connected in different ways in different states. So you can draw different Wilson lines between the subsystems. Okay, so now I've hopefully convinced you that there are emergent non-local degrees of freedom. But it turns out we can describe this in terms of gauge symmetry. So the first step is to construct kinematical states. And for each subsystem, the kinematical states will be will include a purification of the density matrix in that subsystem. So we take the subsystem Hilbert space, and we add an auxiliary Hilbert space, and we find a pure state in that tensor product such that when we trace out the auxiliary degrees of freedom, we get the original density matrix. For simplicity, we can just set the auxiliary degrees of freedom to be some number of qubits. And so what we're doing to construct the kinematical state, we're adding some degrees of freedom to the subsystem. And these are qubits in this case, and I think we should think of these as edge modes. It's more notationally convenient to view the purification as a map. And then we can write the purification condition in this way. And since I'm running out of time, I won't go into full detail, but essentially we can construct these kinematical states by appending a purification to each subsystem. And then if we want to project onto physical states, well, there's a certain way we can do this where we pick some structures and we're able to construct these gluing states. So these are highly entangled states in the auxiliary degrees of freedom, the auxiliary qubits that we've added to each system. And we can use those states to glue together the kinematical states. So for each subsystem, we have an xi, which is the state of its local classical degrees of freedom. We have a psi I, which is a purification, and we simply act with each of these purifications on the gluing states. So yeah, we're projecting the qubits into some entangled setup. And what you can show is that you can obtain any physical state by gluing in this way. And there's a well-defined way to define a constraint surface in the kinematical state space and a map to physical states, which can be thought of as gauge reduction. And you can also glue together any proper subset of the full set of subsystems. So for example, this is how you would glue together the kinematical states of two subsystems. And this only works because the subsystems are classically resolvable. And what this means is, because we can do this in a local way, that the gauge symmetry is fully compatible with the local structure. And what are gauge transformations? Well, the edge modes are these purifications, and we want to a gauge transformation will change these extra imaginary degrees of freedom, but not the rest of the degrees of freedom. So this is a unitary transformation of the purification. So the local gauge group in a subsystem is the unitary group of Ni Xi dimension. So this is a local gauge group, but the global gauge group, you have to impose some condition on these gauge transformations. They have to leave the physical state invariant. So this is how you can define the global gauge group. And this is a state-dependent gauge group, but the same is true in gravity, where the gauge group is a diffeomorphism group of a manifold, which might depend on the topology of the manifold and so on, if you are allowing for variable topology. Okay, to summarize what happened, so for subsystems to have good classical limits, they have to be classically resolvable, so you can determine their full state with classical measurements alone. And if they're classically resolvable, then that implies that the reduced state in any subsystem be approximately proportional to these projection operators. And if the rank of those projection operators is greater than one, then there are emergent non-local degrees of freedom, and they can be accounted for by introducing a gauge symmetry where the kinematical states are purifications, and this means that the edge modes are qubits that we've added to the systems. And you can glue them together by projecting onto these gluing states. And any classical physical observable can be decomposed into a combination of local kinematical observables. What I want to claim is that this at least gives first steps towards a precise picture of entanglement leading to classically emergent gauge symmetry. And I have some more stuff to say, but I only have a few minutes left, so I don't know, I could. How much longer should I go on? Would you?
Go on. Yeah.
Okay.
How long do you need?
I could just go quickly, like 5 or 10 minutes, maybe.
Sure.
Okay, so if you remember the toy model of three spins, there was a lot of group symmetry structure there. And actually, it turns out that toy model is a special case of a much larger class of examples based on unitary irreducible representations of Lie groups. So if we take a Hilbert space as a tensor product and...
Sorry, I have a question.
Yes.
So you mentioned previously that you're just constructing like unitary groups and you, like that's the emergent, like my question is like, how do you say, like how do I see that the entanglement, or how broadly, or rather how broadly is the class of entanglement that I can have, which is taken care of essentially by this emergent mm-hmm. symmetry?
Like what range of features can it express?
Yeah, because as far as I know, like if I have a four-inch entangled phase, and then you're just taking like the unitary transformations of the purification, which to me seems like a finite depth quantum circuit, which is just applying a whole bunch of unitaries, mm-hmm. and that preserves whether you have a short-range entanglement or long-range entanglement.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of like you're just moving within those classes.
Right. It'd be interesting to explore. I mean, there's this condition on whether a gauge transformation is in the global gauge group obviously depends on these gluing states. And there can be very long range entanglement in these gluing states. So there's, the local, like I say, the local gauge transformations are these unitaries, but when you want to find the actual true gauge group, you have to impose some very non-local conditions.
Right, as you said, these are state dependent, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Maybe could we have, after, like, since it's over time,
okay.
Issues and then you have questions,
okay.
So that people can leave.
So this broader class of examples basically you take Hilbert, the subsystem Hilbert spaces carry unitary irreducible representations of Lie groups, and the classical state spaces are coadjoint orbits of that group. And I describe in a paper how if you do this, if you take just a simple tensor product and you don't entangle these states, then you don't get emergent gauge symmetry. That's kind of obvious. But in the paper, I describe a way in which you can entangle these states together in a specific way. It's parameterized by a choice of a subgroup. And what I show is that this yields a good classical limit with the structure that I have described, and also that all of the subsystems will be classically resolvable. And I explain exactly which group is the gauge group. It turns out it's not exactly H, even though H parameterized how we entangled these states. It's some other group. For the case of the three-spin toy model, the groups for each subsystem were an SU2, and H was the diagonal subgroup, and it just happened to be that K equals H. So this gives a very large class of classical limits with gauge symmetry emerging from entanglement. And I think it demonstrates it's not just a sort of a curiosity, it's a fairly generic phenomenon. I have some slides just on possible gravitational aspects, very vague. But so there's a very general expectation among some communities that spacetime can emerge from entanglement. So the diffeomorphism invariance should also emerge from entanglement, and this is a very generic mechanism of how this could happen. So I'd obviously be great if it was somehow, if you could get a better grasp of that. So subregions in gravity, the density matrix can often be written in this way, where A hat now is an area operator. At least this is true in holography. And in the classical limit, which here is G going to zero, this will be proportional to a projection operator onto minimal area states. So it's the kind of, And you can also show that the fidelity of these reduced density matrices in different states will go to zero in the classical limit, which implies that the projection operators are approximately mutually orthogonal. So this is consistent with the classical resolvability. And this can also be shown in some simple models of tensor network, some simple holographic models with tensor networks. There's this happy model, for example. And if you attach coherent states to the bulk legs of these tensor networks, you can show that, you get classical resolvability in the same way. I mentioned about variable bulk topology. This is very speculative, but as I said, there's different entanglement in different states. So according to this mechanism, there are different kinds of non-local degrees of freedom in different neighborhoods of the classical state space. And if you can have different kinds of non-local degrees of freedom, that kind of indicates that there are different ways you can connect up the subsystems. So maybe we should think of that as variable topology. There's this work on modular symmetries in gravity, modular symmetries here, there's two kinds of modular symmetry. I don't mean the symmetries of a torus or whatever. Modular symmetries in this case just means the things which commute with the density matrices of the subsystems. And in gravity, these have an interpretation as transformations of geometric edge modes. So maybe there's a link here between that can be explored with entanglement. One more thing is that quantum error correction has had important implications. And there's a way you can think about that here. So we started with a quantum theory without gauge symmetry. We went to a classical theory which had gauge symmetry. But maybe we can now take that classical theory and quantize it in a way that preserves gauge symmetry. And what we would end up with is two different quantum theories, one which has the gauge symmetry and one which doesn't. And there's a sense in which you can embed one inside of the other. And I think QEC maybe gives a way to understand this. OK, so quickly, We have a general mechanism for this emergent gauge symmetry. Came from understanding classical resolvability. Described this toy model and this group theory generalization and evidence for the gravitational possibilities. Future directions. Yes, I want to very much understand the phase space structure, so the symplectic structure and so on. And I think the Berry curvature will give a way of exploring that. This was a classical limit, so I want to understand the semi-classical limit. And I had these assumptions about the Hilbert space being finite dimensional and type 1 algebras and being factors. So you should loosen all of those assumptions and see what happens. There are some specific gravitational applications which are more concrete that I'd like to explore. So for example, we know what the symmetry group of a subsystem in gravity has to be. It has to be this corner symmetry group. And recently, there's been some understanding of the coadjoint orbits of corner symmetry groups. I would like to understand how to apply my general results about subgroups of corner symmetry of groups and coadjoint orbits to that case. And also, the toy model with three spins is sort of similar to a very simple spin network state, but different in strange ways. So I would like to understand that relationship. Also, I want to understand other possibilities with classical resolvability. And also, I haven't said anything about dynamics, so that would be something to explore. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Joshua. We have some time for a couple of quick questions, maybe from students first. And for people on Zoom, please raise your virtual hand if you have a question. Okay, I don't see any students raising. Oh, yeah, okay. There's on Zoom, Takato Mori.
Yes. Hi. Can I ask a question?
Sure, yeah.
Here, you are considering a classical limit and also the quantum case, but if you consider some, my question is there any relation to renormalization group flow? And my speculation is in classical limit, the projector appearing in your talk is just rank one, but if you consider some small rank but no rank one projector, does it imply we're taking a limit close to classical limit, but not entirely classical? And could it be related to some renormalization group flow?
Thank you. I haven't thought about the relationship with renormalization so much. With regards to your question about the rank of the projection operator, so I guess all throughout this talk I had approximate equality signs, which are supposed to represent convergence in the classical limit. I didn't say anything really about what kind of convergence I was imposing. And so obviously that raises the question if the projection operator rank is, it converges to one, but it's still larger than one. What does that mean, classically? I haven't thought too much about what renormalization would do in this case, but perhaps there's a way to understand renormalization where you, so say you have a division into some number of subsystems, then you could combine two subsystems, you could combine pairs of subsystems and make that your new division into subsystems. I don't know, it's interesting. I don't know if I'm anything good.
So in your talk, the projection operator is to which subspace? Sorry, I think I just missed.
So
the subspace is some some spatial subregion, then you might view it as kind of real space renormalization. But in this case, projection onto which subspace? Sorry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess I left that kind of vague. So the projection, well, I guess you mean the subsystem projection operators, but it's the projection onto the subspace of Hilbert space on which the degrees of freedom within a certain subsystem are close in value to the state that parametrizes that projection operator. This is I'm assuming structure here. Obviously, to define these projection operators, you need to understand how things are regularized and everything. I'm sweeping all that under the rug. I'm assuming we have some way of defining these operators that gives them this these classical properties.
Thank you.
Sure. Yes.
Further questions? Okay. Bianca was first, and then go on.
There's the fact that kind of all infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces are equivalent.
Mm-hmm.
And so we indeed can construct lots of different classical systems. Without gauge symmetries.
Mm-hmm.
But your example is actually finite dimensional. Are there some conditions then to classify the kind of gauge symmetries you can get there? How surprising is it, given that all Hilbert spaces are kind of equal, if you don't specify any structure, you can indeed put lots of interpretation into the systems.
Mm-hmm. So I guess there's the question of which structure you should use to define the classical limit, I didn't say anything about. But for instance, the dynamics of the theory will tell you a lot about that. So it's true that if what you're saying is every quantum theory has the same Hilbert space and there's additional structure that you're using to get the actual physical interpretations on top of that. And I think I didn't talk about a lot of those additional structures. And dynamics is one, the measurement apparatus is another, I think that the thing I'm pointing out is that there is that ambiguity at both the classical and the quantum levels. The ambiguity at the quantum level has significant impacts at the classical level, and there's a translation there, and the translation turns entanglement in the quantum side into gauge symmetry in the classical side. It's true that with some additional structures, you'll be able to constrain what kinds of states you want to consider in the quantum theory. But if you've already done that, the kind of states that you're considering will be entangled in certain ways. And then if you then take the classical limit, that will turn into this gauge symmetry.
And I have a more technical question, because you used the Gelfand Neimark theorem.
Mm-hmm.
But if I remember correctly, which might not be the case, you're basically using it, or then it can be represented as an algebra of commutative function on some space that you can construct directly from
mm-hmm.
the construct. The description in the theorem. But this works again with respect to a given polarization, meaning it's only you reconstruct the function, say, on position space, not on phase space. No?
Yeah.
Usually that's why it was the same phase space as S2 or S3 as a limit. Now you can get different topology.
Yeah, no, I'm asking in the examples of I have the impression that if I remember correctly, which might not be the case, I get some functions.
Yeah, I think if you're applying it to
IPG, we get the full Hilbert space, but only apply it fluxes.
But here I'm using the additional structure of the classical limit. So that would be true if the operators that I was considering were the projections onto position eigenstates, then the space of functions would be functions
on X.
But here I'm using sort of an approximate version of the Gelfand-Neimark theorem, where it's an approximately commutative C star algebra, so I can.
I didn't want that. I saw that.
Okay. Yeah.
But even if you use the strict one, like for the usual phase space, you know, the topology could be Rn or it could be a double torus, like. Mm-hmm. There's different classical limit in the
Yeah, no, that's what I was saying. I'm aware of that. I was just, I'm again just kind of asking whether it's possible to just get position space, kind of. But yeah.
Yeah.
So
I think it's
interesting. It would be interesting to see what the symplectic structure is.
Oh, yeah.
But on S3 and S3 vetch, no, S3, tensor S3.
Mm-hmm. What is the theorem that you're referring to?
It's S3 cross S3 or S3 tensor S3. It appears in our context for so-called quantum deformation of SU2. And so then the phase space, that's called a quantum double, is more like SU2 cross SU2. But in fact, like one copy of SU2 is conjugated to the other copy, which does not exactly seem to be the case in your case. And I know that in my discussion that the mathematical theory to describe even the classical phase space is a bit involved. And I would have to find these things. And a long time ago, we tried to indeed define symplectic structure, but I found a theorem somewhere, but it's kind of hidden and it's from 10 years ago. So as that basically. That basically says that S3 cross S3 doesn't have a completely, I'm not remember whether it was about not having a symplectic structure or even restricting the Poisson structure. So we are aware of one weaker notion of symplectic structure, which comes from this quantum group.
Okay.
But then these two S3 factors we have in this case, it's a bit unlikely that it corresponds to your case. Because one structure is just SE2, and the other is a deformed version of the fluxes, and they're kind of completely conjugated to the first SU2.
Well, I don't think
it's a technical thing.
No, yeah, it would be interesting to
get something a symplectic structure for this S3 cross S3. It would be already interesting to see just for this peculiar mathematical reason.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't be so hard, I guess, to compute the Berry curvature of these states. You just, you'd put some derivatives with respect to the parameters. I'd be really interested in seeing how that works with this theorem.
Yeah, okay, maybe two questions, but we can keep it quick. The first one is maybe about the gravitational. So here, you have that the gauge room is always kind of a product of SUN or UN. But then in gravity what we expect is to get a product of diffeomorphism group, like diff of S and maybe local boost algebra. So should I, what should I learn? Should I learn that I should let go of diff S, or should think of diff S as being allowed? I mean, because I know in holography people know about UN, the connection between UN and diffeomorphism symmetry is completely inexistent at this stage. So what's your stab on that?
So my stab is that.
Where's the diffeomorphism?
Right, yes. Yeah. So there's this Ni in general. I think it's not going to be a finite number in the classical limit. Maybe it scales with 1 over G or something like that. So I've brushed aside that issue, but when I take the classical limit, this will be a unitary group at very large N, and then there'll be some complicated conditions which give me some subgroup of the product of unitary groups. I don't know exactly how that works, but I think there's a lot of room there for finding, you know, this will be an infinite dimensional group, so you'll be able to find some regularized infinite dimensional group inside of it, which is maybe a regularized version of a diffeomorphism group.
Okay, that's kind of an open challenge for many, many years. Is it possible to
right.
regularize diff symmetry?
Mm-hmm.
People have tried one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, this is a...
So maybe, does that give you, do we get new information on that for the fundamental questions? No?
One...
DFS should be coming as a subgroup of a product of unitaries.
Well, yeah, it's somewhere in there, maybe. I don't know. The thing that I was interested in, I mean, this UN is sort of it's the symmetry group of the qubit edge modes that I've attached to the subsystem. And I've ignored the issue of dynamics, obviously, but the state of those qubits will evolve in some way. I wanted to understand if there's some way to understand that as like a unitary matrix model at some large rank where the rank is this NIXI. And obviously that's sort of a regularized version of a brain and the brain here would be the corner maybe of the sub-region. But yeah, I can't say any more than that, apart from that there seems to be room for that structure. And I would like to, yeah. I made a lot of assumptions about finite dimensional Hilbert spaces and everything, so there might be some extra stuff that comes about when you go to like type 2 and type 3 Riemann algebras and stuff like that. That's something I want to explore as well.
Okay. Since we are running a little bit over time, let's close the seminar. And thank you very much, Joshua.
Thank you.